This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
2010, the year of mergers and acquisitions.
How about one last billion-dollar deal for good luck?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, December 29th. Coming up, the BP oil spill doesn't appear to have deterred oil companies from looking for profits deep underwater. And the job picture has gotten so bad that the government is going to change the way it measures unemployment.
But first, the online coupon site Groupon may raise almost $1 billion from private investors to fuel its growth. The company's board has approved the move just a few weeks after Groupon reportedly rejected a $6 billion buyout offer from Google. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is with us now with details. Hi, Mitchell.
Hey, Jeremy.
So for those of us who are not venture capitalists, why does today's news about Groupon matter?
Well, because it shows just how fast this whole sector is growing. If you don't already know, here's how this works. I get an email every day from Groupon. It offers me a coupon for a shop here in Portland, maybe 50% off pet supplies, or I could have gotten 80% off Pilates classes earlier this week. Now, Groupon's only 2 years old. It's already profitable. It's in 300 cities. It's expanding in Europe and Asia. Carl Howe is a technology analyst at the Yankee Group. He told me that sites like Facebook haven't necessarily figured out how to turn their popularity into money, but Groupon may have cracked this code.
This is the rise of social buying. We saw social networking rise with Facebook. This is now turning that into money. They get paid up front, and the coupons are left in consumers' pockets. So it's really a good way to print money.
A good way to print money, Mitchell, and this would be the biggest venture capital financing of a startup company since the mid-90s. Does that signal anything broader about the health of the economy?
Well, you know, maybe not the economy as a whole, but definitely investors' appetite for e-commerce as a growth industry. Carl Howe pointed out to me that Groupon's spreading faster than any internet trend. Its best-known competitor, Living Social, just raised $175 million from Amazon to expand.
All right, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman in Portland, Oregon. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Groupon's not the only company getting buyout offers and venture capital financing. 2010 was the year mergers and acquisitions returned to the economy. Global mergers were up almost 20% this year, and more are expected next year. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports on what that means for the job market.
When companies merge, it might mean a new name on your paycheck.
Hey, you guys, what's the name of the new company going to be?
We combine Morgan and Poland. Moland Spring.
Moland?
Or it might mean no paycheck. Mergers often lead to layoffs. David Becker teaches finance at Drexel University. He says layoffs will be minimal. Companies are already running lean and mean.
It's going to be very hard to slash a workforce when you do a merger if you've already cut to the bone.
And that's why he calls this round of mergers strategic. Companies have stockpiled cash during the recession, a historic stash of nearly $2 trillion. Shareholders want returns, so now bigger firms are buying smaller ones that will grow, eventually. But that doesn't do much for the job market right now, says James Brock at Miami University. What would? Companies growing internally.
That is new plant, new equipment, research and development, rather than just buying something that somebody else has already built.
I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
So mergers and acquisitions will be one big story of 2010. But what else was there? Jobs, housing, the BP oil spill? Let's bring in Richard DeKayser. He's chief economist at the Parthenon Group, and we'll get his thoughts on the year's biggest business story. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
So for you, what is the most important economic story of 2010?
Well, I think it's the stabilization of the housing market. You know, this was the absolute epicenter of the collapse of the Great Recession. the news is certainly not good, but the market is stabilized. Home sales today, if you look at the big picture, new existing condos, single families, basically where they were at the very low point of 2009. There's been a lot of volatility, but we've seen a floor on home sales. Home construction is actually moving up a little bit. So I'll call it a qualified good news story in staunching the utter collapse and free fall of housing, which seems to have played out over the past year.
And what about for the next year, Richard? We got some sort of disappointing noise news about home prices yesterday. What do you think is going to happen next year with the housing market?
You're absolutely right. The Case-Shiller Index showed a home price decline in the month of October. Very disappointing. But this is part and parcel of what we're seeing. Another indicator, the FHFA price index, showed an increase in the same month, and that's what you see at these moments when indicators are mixed. Stabilization is the story. And going forward, I think we'll see this more of the same, bottoming along, maybe modest gains as lenders loosen up the purse strings a little bit, but we've still got to work off a big inventory. So I'd say slogging ahead is the story for housing in 2011.
Well, let's hope you're right, at least that things are going to get better. Richard DeKayser, chief economist at the Parthenon Group, thanks and Happy New Year.
My pleasure, and same to you.
Research from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago has found that the ever-popular rewards credit cards, like cards that give you cash back or airline miles, cause people to spend more and go into more debt. Jeremy, do you have a rewards card?
I do. I have one that gives me airline miles.
Oh, do you think it makes you spend more?
I think it makes me spend more on that card. Maybe in the end it does make me spend more because I'm using more credit and less cash.
Well, this study found that for a 1% cashback reward, a cardholder usually got about $25 a month, but they would increase their spending by about $70 a month, and they would boost their credit card debt by $115 a month. So
so there you go. Maybe I am spending more.
But Ron Shevlin disagrees. He's a banking products analyst with the Aite Group, and he joins us now. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
So the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago finds reward cards can be hazardous to a consumer's finances. But from what I understand, you're a little skeptical of that.
I have a couple issues with the way the study was conducted. First of all, I think we have to remember that it was conducted between the 2000 and 2002 time period, which was a period of increasing unemployment. Unemployment increased from about 4% in 2000 to 6% in 2002. And so in tough economic times, people are going to spend more regardless of the type of card they have. The other issue is that the study was conducted among a single card issuer's base of cardholders, and different card issuers target different types of consumers. And so it's possible that the underlying cardholders that are reflected in this study are not really representative of cardholders in general.
It was also before the credit crunch.
And before the credit crunch, and also before the proliferation of a lot more different types of reward cards. So I think there's some issues with the timing of the study.
Now, you've done your own research on rewards cards and reward cards users. What have you found?
Pretty much the opposite of what the Fed has found. In the consumer research that I've conducted over the past couple of years, we tend to find that consumers who are reward card holders, first of all, tend to have higher income and higher levels of affluence, and therefore are actually less likely to be what we'd call revolvers, people who revolve their credit card balance and run up interest payments.
Right.
And so they tend to be people who don't care about the rates or the fees on the card because they're not going to generate interest payments. They're going to pay that card off every month and get rewards cards so that they can max out on their rewards.
And just really quickly, what kind of rewards cards are we getting now that we are starting to get credit card offers again, and are they a good deal?
Well, we're starting to see, I think, a greater proliferation of the types of reward cards. I think in general, if you kind of look back over the past couple years, the trend has gone from travel-focused reward cards to cash back and now to things like more merchandise, where you're getting better deals and discounts on specific types of merchandise.
Right.
This is very helpful, especially for the card issuers, because they're helping to drive more sales to the merchants and retailers who are helping to pick up some of the cost of the reward cards. And so what this means from the consumer perspective is that there's better choice among cards. You don't have to be limited to just travel. And second of all, if you're a type of consumer who is going to use the credit card more as a payment card than as a credit card, rewards cards can be a great deal for you.
Ron Shevlin, senior analyst with the Aite Group. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, December 29th. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? Looks like the BP oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico did not deter deep water drilling. The global oil industry will spend more than ever looking for new oil and gas wells next year. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
A new oil survey shows that spending on new wells, platforms, and drilling rigs will hit almost $500 billion next year. That's an 11% increase on 2010. This suggests confidence in the oil industry that the increase in the price of crude will hold. So extra production should be profitable. But also there's the growing cost of operating in tricky conditions. Companies will splash out even more on deep water drilling, for example. Big oil has not been deterred by BP's disaster. Dr. Clifford Jones is an energy expert at Aberdeen University.
Oil production and oil exploration won't stop. They can't, because the world needs 80 million barrels of oil a day. And that state of affairs can't be changed in response to one event, however tragic.
But the disaster is adding more cost to offshore oil exploration in the US, as drilling permits there are now harder to come by. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
India has become the latest country to tighten trade sanctions with Iran. The US has been pushing India to do that for years. The hope is that it will put pressure on Iran's nuclear program. From New Delhi, the BBC's Mark Dummett joins us now. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So, Mark, what exactly has India agreed to do?
Well, this week, the Reserve Bank of India instructed the country's lenders to stop using the Asian Clearing Union to process payments for the import of oil and gas from Iran. And this is significant because this system, which was set up in 1974 to help trade between Iran and South Asian countries like India, means that deals between the two can go through each country's central banks, making it much harder for the US and others to trace money flows in and out of Iran. And the US says that blacklisted Iranian firms have been exploiting this system.
Why is the trading relationship between India and Iran so significant?
Well, trade between the two has been rising in recent years, and India is Iran's biggest partner by far through this system, the Asian Clearing Union. Out of a total of $900 million owed to Iran through this system in November, $800 million was owed to it by Indian firms.
Wow. Why has India made this decision now? Do we have any sense of that?
Well, no, because India hasn't given any official reason or statement on this issue. But the suspicion, of course, is that it has done so at the request of the US government. As you know, the US and India are becoming increasingly close economically, right, diplomatically, strategically, as we saw so well just last month during Barack Obama's visit to India.
That is the BBC's Mark Dummett. He joins us from New Delhi. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Stacey, the U.S. Postal Service, which lost more than $8 billion in the last fiscal year, has a new idea.
Okay.
Starting in January, reports say all first-class stamps will be considered forever stamps. Everything will be a forever stamp.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So you'll be able to use them forever, regardless of
we'll
any changes
load up on
in the
stamps.
Cost. Exactly. Buy now, because 10 years from now, they might be, I don't know, 58 cents a piece or something like that. It did seem to me that the only thing now at the Postal Service that will not be forever is, I don't know, the Postal Service?
Oh,
mail delivery.
Jeremy, that's so harsh.
Buy the stamps, you might not be able to mail anything with them.
I believe, Post Office, I believe. You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, December 29th. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. The latest look at the markets is at marketplace.org. Just go to the numbers section.
Well, now to a couple of stories about the new normal for the U.S. economy. So many Americans have been out of work for so long that the U.S. government is changing the way it measures long-term unemployment. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that story.
Until now, the Bureau of Labor Statistics hasn't counted anyone as being unemployed for longer than 2 years. Tom Nardone is an assistant commissioner of the Bureau.
I think it goes back to the days when it actually was a paper form that was filled out and only two digits were allowed.
So anyone out of work for more than 100 weeks was recorded as 99 weeks. But Nardone says that's changing.
when we did look back on the data, we found that we never had this proportion, this 11% who were hitting that top coat. So it wasn't really, you know, an issue.
Beginning with January's jobless report, the average period of unemployment in America is likely to jump.
The reason we're making the change is we suspect that the average duration of unemployment has been understated.
Now, the jobless survey will record people out of work for up to 5 years. Nardone says the more accurate statistics will better measure the true depth of the economic downturn. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Now to a strange economic indicator in the world of trucking. Turns out that in harder times, there may be more of a demand for trucks and by extension, more demand for new drivers. In the latest installment of our Economy 4.0 series about new ways to measure the economy, Marketplace correspondent David Brancaccio reports on what might be called the semi-indicator.
Cuba, Missouri sits along lifelines of American commerce. First, historic Route 66, and now there's Interstate 44, a major artery for trucks across what the U.S. Census identifies as the center of the U.S. population. Cuba is also home to West Wind CDL Training Center, CDL as in commercial driver's license, what you need to drive a truck.
About 300 drivers a year come through.
Mark Leathers, formerly of the Missouri Highway Patrol, is West Wind's boss. His team gives newbie drivers 3 weeks of basic training. There's a few weeks more instruction once they get hired by trucking companies. It's Leathers with the surprising theory that trucking thrives during a downturn.
The trucking industry is really big right now. With the economic conditions the way they are, the bigger companies can't afford to warehouse near the material they used to. So now, these companies, when they need something, they've got to have it now. They can't wait on it, or it's not sitting in the back room somewhere. Everything is trucks. As soon as they call for it, it's on its way.
When companies are being careful during unsettled economic times, they may push the famed just-in-time delivery idea to its limits. Having low inventories of parts or products saves money. But Rosalind Wilson, a transportation analyst at Delcan Corporation, says trucking goes up when the economy goes up, not the other way around. Still, she says it's a useful economic indicator.
If you actually look at the numbers compared to last year, trucking is doing great. You know, 5.9, 10.1% increase over previous year, except the previous year was so low that we still aren't back up to where we were prior to the recession.
The boom at the driving school may stem from a shortage of drivers as older ones retire. It's calculated the country needs 400,000 new truckers this year and next. First years can earn into the high 30s annually, if they don't mind the hours, the traffic, or the time away from home. In Cuba, Missouri, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
This week marks the final application deadline for a lot of colleges, and getting those applications done is no easy task, although I think it was a lot harder when we applied to college. because you couldn't apply online, or maybe you could apply online.
No, I was sending off things. I was, you know, stamping the letters and
the
getting them off by 5 p.m., you know, before
The
deadline.
When the post office still existed.
That's right.
Getting those applications in, of course, is no easy task. Students have to write an essay, they have to get recommendations and take tests. So some parents are now hiring pros to oversee the process. Colorado Public Radio's Zachary Barr reports.
Before hiring her, parents sometimes ask educational consultant Diane Schaefer if she can get their kid into Princeton.
We do not guarantee that students can get in places. And if a consultant is telling someone that they can do that, then that's an unethical consultant.
For a fee, Schaefer guides high school seniors through the entire college application process, from figuring out where to apply to making sure applications are sent in on time. Educational consultants like Schaefer are in high demand. When she joined a trade group of fellow consultants about 10 years ago,
there were just a handful of people. And for our membership now to swell to close to 600 is a statement about the growth of this industry.
So how much does one of these college gurus cost?
Well, I charge $4,200, and it's a two-year process.
It's impossible to know, really, whether it's worth it or not.
Nevertheless, Denver physician Bill Mangione hired Diane Schaefer. Mangione says he wanted to give his daughter, Rachel, the best chance to get into her top schools. And he wanted to keep the peace at home.
It takes the potential conflicts of deadlines out of the household and moves it somewhere else, namely between Rachel and Diane.
Rachel's grateful for her parents' decision.
I would rather not fight with my parents over college applications, and I'm more likely to listen to an expert like Diane than my mom.
Rachel's applying to 11 schools. She says thanks to Diane's help, all of her applications are finished and ready to send out on time. In Denver, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
And finally, just in case there was any doubt that the 80s are back, skinny jeans, Jeremy.
Uh-oh.
Skinny jeans. The top-earning rock concerts in 2010 look a lot like the top-earning rock concerts when Tab and Crimping Irons roamed the earth. All right, Jeremy, a guess for the top five concerts this year.
Oh, man. So we're talking about from the 80s. I don't know. Prince, maybe?
Not even.
No.
AC/DC and Metallica were both in the top five slots this year. I know. We're going kind of hardcore. And coming in at number one, the man who gave love a bad name.
Oh, Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi. He sold more than $200 million worth of tickets
God.
In 2010. I know.
He's got to be big somewhere overseas, I bet, in order for that to work.
Right? It must be.
Get a rebirth abroad.
Yes, you do. And now, if only I could remember where I put my hammer pants, we could go.
That'll be next year's top act, Stacey.
That's true. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.